I just wanted to start first with, you know, given that interdisciplinarity of your work and what you study and research at the University of Kentucky, I would love to know how you would prefer to, I guess, call what you're doing in relationship to others, not only within the academy, but also outside of it.
Big question. And I think it's a very intriguing question, because with what is happening with digital technologies, and although we've, you know, seen them coming on for 20, 30 years now, it is still, I don't think we've really got our minds totally wrapped around what the significance actually is. But I think that the larger issue is, with the digital technologies, what types of questions can we now ask that we haven't been able to ask in the past? And in thinking about my work, I do think about it as interdisciplinary, but in some ways, that's kind of a fallacy. It seems like we organize disciplines in ways to ask certain types of questions. And how we define things gives us borders so that we can ask those questions and generate knowledge and generate understanding, have insights into things. So how I like to kind of think about my work is that the interdisciplinary nature of it allows me to define my subject slightly differently and my questions slightly differently. Or what I should say, define my subject slightly differently so that it can lead to different types of questions.
You classify yourself more as, and tell me if I'm wrong, as a visual rhetorician, as someone who's definitely situated in rhetoric and composition, but is looking at the visual nature of how we compose and create and diversify arguments. And so is that somewhat correct?
Yes, that would be correct. I think that I'm always disinclined to name what I'm doing too directly, or to give myself a title or attach myself to an ism in some ways. I've always said that isms make Billy a dull boy. And I think that, you know, it's helpful to think about and focus my research in a way of thinking about that I'm working on visuals. And I do consider myself at the heart being a visual rhetorician. But I think what that is and where that can take us is evolving as we go along. And I think that, you know, the issues that the digital humanities open for us, it's really astounding. But I think that one way to think about digital is as a methodology. And I think when you start thinking about the digital as a methodology, it shifts that sense of what it is in such a way. So I can be a visual rhetorician working in the digital realm, but it's that digital piece that allows, again, certain types of questions to be answered. It kind of redefines the world in a way, but I think through a methodological one.
In kind of thinking about what you said about subject matter, I am very curious, too, if you can talk a little bit about how you first became interested in studying illuminated manuscripts, and if you could just talk a little bit about that genesis.
I got interested in the Book of Kells by actually not being able to see it. My wife and I went to England, and we had a couple extra days, and we both had wanted to see Ireland for a good long while. And so we took our rental car, hopped the ferry, and headed over to Dublin. And driving in Dublin is just a zoo, because you have just all these old, basically cart paths that have been turned into roads. And you can have roads that parallel each other going in circles. So we got totally lost. We never made it to Trinity College. And I was heartbroken, because one of the things I wanted to see while I was there was the Book of Kells. When we returned, the University of Arizona actually had the new facsimile that was done in 1990, first full color facsimile that was completed for the manuscript, available in special collections. And when I looked at the manuscript, I just fell in love with it. My interest in visuals has been, and especially since W.J.T. Mitchell talked about our visual turn, is that how do we migrate into a visual world from one that is based in text with all the intellectual apparatus that surrounds text? And what I found in the Book of Kells and in the illuminated manuscripts, that you had this intellectual tradition that was based in expressing itself through visuals. And in this, I said, ah, this is what I want to look at. This is what I want to study. I want to see how another tradition developed in using the images as a way of expressing intellectual content that might tell us something about our own world and the possibilities that are before us with digital technologies. I think the interesting thing about the work is that the codex or the book was such a different beast at that point in time, and that the printing press changed the manuscripts so dramatically. So that I've actually learned as much about text as I've probably actually learned about images themselves. So that's how I kind of got started with the Book of Kells. But my real interest, I mean, as a piece of art, it is just absolutely gorgeous. It's just breathtaking. And that has been just a joy in working with the manuscript. When I was working on my dissertation, friends would be kind of drudging along a little bit with things. And if I hit upon, you know, a problem, it was like, darn, I've got to go over to Special Collections and look through this beautiful book. Woe is me. So that's been a real fun aspect of the project itself. But I think, you know, as I've kind of worked into it, the thing that has surprised me about the Book of Kells is because the Vikings came through, destroyed so many of the records because of civil wars and other wars, we don't know what a lot of the imagery actually means. And I thought that my time with the Book of Kells would be shorter than what it's turned out to be. Because there's so much mystery in the imagery, having a rhetorician approach it is much different than having an art historian approach it or a medievalist approach it. So I'm able to ask slightly different questions, particularly questions thinking about the making, thinking about invention, thinking about rhetorical memory, that aren't at the heart of the other disciplines. So I'm hoping that I can contribute some real substantial things to the understanding of these manuscripts and understanding their visual architecture as a whole versus individual images. We tend to think about images having individualistic meaning and not accumulating like the words do over the length of a book. When we start thinking about a book like the Book of Kells, we have references of images all the way through. So in many ways, the images can work as a counter-narrative. They also can work as a concept or a meta-concept for how to read and focus on the text. So it's a very sophisticated and wonderful way of using them. One of the things that had slowed scholars down as well is that color is very important to these manuscripts. And when you think that a book as important as the Book of Kells only had a color facsimile in 1990, with the delicacy of these manuscripts, people just couldn't spend the time looking at the images to really figure out what was going on in them. So it's really, the digital has kind of opened up some really intriguing ways of doing scholarship and opened up avenues of knowing that we didn't have previously.
Something that you said really struck me just about how advanced this is as a concept and even a meta concept in terms of how we're pairing the visual with also with the text and also just reading about the Book of Kells and also other examples of just how precise these books are. And just in terms of it's amazing that they're hand lettered in terms of a lot of the things that they're doing, and also just hand drawn and just the handmade aspect of it. And I'm also just, I think in that statement, one of the things that really struck me was I feel like we're seeing a huge resurgence. You know, a lot of people talk about multimodal composition, mm-hmm. And really reconsidering more and more just in the world around us, obviously with the internet and everything that's part of it, of how visuals play a huge role and how we consume media and text. And so I'm very curious too, in terms of looking back in the past and seeing those kinds of things in these illuminated manuscripts, if it does give you kind of a greater sense of perspective in terms of how we're approaching text today.
Yes. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about this period of illuminated manuscripts I'm studying, it's called the Insular Period. The manuscripts were made from about 550, 600 to 850 until the Vikings came in and wreaked havoc. So you've got about this 250, 300-year period of time where the Irish and the English, actually the Saxons, are kind of inventing a way of visual expression. And so in many ways, it's kind of a nice way of looking in and seeing how these different cultures are coming together around Christianity. And when you pull in the fact that the manuscripts are in Latin, and Latin wasn't a native language in Ireland, there was still some Latin being spoken in England from the time that the Romans were there, but that had pretty much, you know, passed on with all the Germanic tribes. So you've got this really interesting moment in time where you've got a language that isn't orally spoken that has to be learned, and then you also have a visual expression and a sense of faith. So as those things come together, it's intriguing how the Celtic cultures focused on certain design features. One of the things in the Irish culture is that there's a tradition of threes, which some scholars have suggested or thought perhaps that it was very influential in helping Christianity catch on so quickly. There was never any martyrdom of Christians in Ireland in any big fashion, which is quite astounding. And they even had to invent a form of martyrdom called white martyrdom, where you left your country for the sake of Christ, never to return, so that they would have a gateway into heaven that would be in a parallel path of a red martyr who's someone who is killed. So these cultural manifestations play out in really fascinating ways, along with the codexes that were able to come into both England and Ireland from the Mediterranean, from the Byzantine Empire. They all had this wonderful way of picking, choosing, incorporating different aspects, and developing. And one of the interesting things that I'm working on at this point in time is that when you start working with images and thinking about visual expression, there seems to be kind of two different genealogical strands that are developing. That the great Gospels, the illuminated manuscripts, were definitely for show. And there's some disagreement as far as whether they were actually read from or not. But there was an emphasis on reading correctly. And there was some serious penance for not reading correctly at a service. So in one strand, there's a lot of attention paid to layout, where the text is actually transcribed in two columns in sense units so that you could speak it more easily. The Irish actually invented space between words to help people in their reading, punctuation as well. So there's an emphasis on reading, but at the same time, there's this another strand that is more interested in the visual expression of the faith, which we get to with the Book of Kells. And part of that may have been that there would be processions of saints' relics that would bring money into the church. So whether the gospel books were used for that in Ireland, it's hard to say. Clearly at large services, they would open the gospel books up at pages. There are different rites that we have records of in Rome, where they would even use four different great gospel books, and they would move around and be open to different pages throughout the services. So their focus, suddenly, although they contain the Word of God, was more important, or just as important, the expression visually. And so they start developing techniques where they can move text around on the page to make room for imagery. So suddenly we have the word not as a oral phenomenon or even as a literate phenomenon as we think about it for meaning, but as a visual phenomenon, as in typography. Mm-hmm. And that is where it suddenly becomes more important. And one of the great inventions during this period as well was the use of vellum instead of other materials to write on. And the great thing about vellum is that a quill and the inks will flow very smoothly over vellum, so you can get a beautiful script. So part of the beauty of these manuscripts, which I was going to say unfortunately, or I'm not sure quite what I want to say, but it's the technology. The technology, just like our digital technologies are making, you know, video happen today, vellum allowed for those beautiful scripts on those manuscripts.
But so in thinking about Walter Ong and his memory and the research that surrounds me at St. Louis University in particular, I'm really curious to hear your thoughts about, this is a huge question, but how these illuminated manuscripts might help us think a little bit more about that transition from orality to literacy, and then even thinking beyond this particular historical vantage point too, to seeing the word as a feature not only of these beautifully rendered, scripts and images on this vellum, but also thinking through how the word is maybe shifting today to the internet and how we see it too. Because I think I'm always really, really intrigued by that parallel, and maybe that parallelism I need to not superimpose on that, Bill, and feel free to say that's the wrong way to look at it. But I'm really trying to wrap my head around how what you're studying might be an excellent precursor for to also think a little bit more about what we're experiencing in our own time.
No, I think the question you're asking is really at the heart of the matter, or at one of the hearts of the matters. And I think that, you know, people, or I should say, some people, particularly in the 90s, were very nervous about digital technologies and the image because of how we think about text and how Walter Ong actually opened up a sense of thinking about Gutenberg's invention, thinking about writing and how it shaped our consciousness, how writing opened up ways of thinking to us that it's always hard to say that they weren't possible before, but clearly it made them much easier. It's hard to think about a book-length argument before writing and what that might look like. But clearly, we have our intellectual tradition very much, I mean, our intellectual tradition is the book in many ways. We can't separate the two. But when I move into this territory, I always think Plato had it right. And his skepticism towards writing was really, I think, spot on in the fact that knowledge stops living when it's written down and that it can't respond to context. And I think that where we probably moved through, and one of our biggest challenges with writing and what makes for good writing many times is bringing in that context so that context is part of the expression. And I think that that was probably something that Plato didn't have time to think through. And I think it's probably taken us hundreds of years to think through how to weave context into a piece of writing to make it more viable. But still, context shift, and we misunderstand, I think, a lot sometimes of what is in writing itself. So as we're kind of moving into kind of the digital realm, I think one of the interesting things for me is that how something like video pulls context back into the equation in really dynamic ways. It's hard to feel the same way about something when you're seeing pictures of it versus just hearing about it. I can describe the Book of Kells to you, but seeing it is a whole nother experience. And I think that with the move from writing, and where I think Plato has his finger on something, and I think we're moving back towards this and we're rethinking this, and I think it's probably going to change how we write as well, because I think it'll focus on us on it in even more ways, is that with words, it's very easy to believe in the Cartesian split between mind and body, that words on a page can feel more mental than physical. When we start doing things with the digital, when we start having images, I think it pulls the body back into play and kind of reunites us in a whole being in a way that is just absolutely wonderful. Todd Taylor did a set of interviews on video of Brett Comp people, and I always show a portion of those to my 609 class, the teaching of writing class. And something that always comes out in those videos is just the joy, the dedication, the fascination that the scholars have with teaching writing, but more so just that dedication and joy with what they're doing. It comes out in those videos in ways that I think if Todd Taylor did a great job with the video, but mm-hmm. I think if he would have tried to edit that out, he couldn't have. And I think when people read the scholarship then, they have a different sense having seen these scholars and reading their pieces rather than not seeing these scholars and reading their pieces. And so I think it brings a whole other dimension in. It's like once you've heard a poet read his own work, you read his work differently. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is the constant struggle with writing, is that text on the page does lose something from the performance of that text by the writer. So consequently, I think that Walter Ong is a perfect person to pull back into this equation, because the question is how does this make our consciousness different? How does it make us different intellectuals? How does it make us different people, or invite us to be different people? And of course, we have great say in how we shape our technologies. And I think that's why Cynthia Self and Gail Hallischer's work was so important at the get-go, is to have rhetoric and composition people studying these technologies and getting some say in this from the get-go. One other thing I'll just kind of add on as well, in working with these manuscripts, the conflict at that point in time was between the visual and the oral, and not necessarily the literal and the visual. Mm-hmm. Because it was almost accepted that not everybody would know Latin. But it was, I have to wonder, and this is probably me speculating more than I should, but when I taught English in Japan, I used to love to go over to the train station and write. And hearing people talk in the background, and Japanese and Americans tend to speak very quickly, and my Japanese wasn't so good that I couldn't understand what was being said unless I really paid attention. And the human voice, if it's separated from meaning, sounds just beautiful in concert. And so I used to enjoy that aspect of listening to the human voice. And I have to wonder if that is the experience of people in general, even how well some of the monks and the priests actually knew Latin is really in question. If it was more the experience of hearing the sound of the human voice and having a sense of the meaning rather than being able to follow the meaning. So I think orality had a slightly different sense and tie into consciousness, particularly in the insular world in the British Isles, than what it does for us when we start talking about literacy, orality, and the visual. And I think that when the visual was coming into play. It was coming into play in a realm where there was that oral tradition that may not have been quite as connected to meaning as strongly as we might think it would be.
One of the things that you kind of hit upon that I just would love to know more about, because I think one of the things that really makes me excited just to hear about your trajectory through the academy, but also looking at your research, is also kind of hearing a little bit more about your background as a poet. And because I know you're an accomplished poet. And so one of the things that I guess I am very, very interested in is, has your background as a poet really influenced your definition of Kairos and kind of how you view that?
I think what it has done is it's made invention and Kairos really central to what I do. My beginning work on the Book of Kells, I was really looking at invention techniques that they were using. Mm-hmm. And that's still extremely intriguing to me. And I think I've unraveled it to some extent, but it's really hard to prove that this was what they were up to with it. In the Book of Kells, one of the things that they did is they figured out ways of moving text and displacing it to make room for imagery. But the imagery was never, of course, random imagery. It was very important. And one of the things that the monks were devoted to becoming monks as part of being closer to God. And John Caution had this sense that one wanted to move into a state where they were in a constant, within a constant remembrance of God. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you think about God every moment of the day? That is quite a tough task. But when you start playing with imagery, suddenly there's kind of some clues on how to do this. And one of the traditions has a lion as a symbol for Christ. But the lion portrays many different aspects of Christ. And one of the things that was believed about the lions, and this comes out of a book called The Physiologus, which goes back to Greek and Egyptian tales of animals, it was believed that the lion actually slept with its eyes open, and so that it was forever awake. This particular trait of the lion was associated with Christ having control over life and death, that even on the cross, his spirit was watchful. It was also believed that lions were born, stillborn, and that after 3 days, that the male lion would roar or breathe into the cub's face and bring them to life. So here we've got the imagery of the crucifixion and resurrection. It was believed that the lion only revealed itself to whomever it wanted to see it, so that if it was, you know, out and a hunter was stalking it, it was believed that a lion would actually use its tail to cover its tracks. So when you move into the Book of Kells, you find passages where suddenly, if you read that passage and think that passage in these 4 or 5 different attributes of Christ, it has you inventing ways of seeing into Scripture that you would not see into Scripture otherwise. In the Book of Kells, in some of the passages where these lions appear, I was trying to remember the exact Matthew verse, chapter and verse, and I won't pull that out of my head. But there's there's a moment where Christ is gathering his apostles, and one of them says, well, you know, Christ, I'll come with you, but, you know, let me bury my father first. And Christ says something that sounds just terribly callous. It's like, who is this guy? He says, well, let the dead bury the dead. Come on. Don't worry about that. And so in this particular passage in the Book of Kells, we see the lion appear. And it actually misplaces text, so it slows down your reading. It throws it the line above. And so in that moment, when Christ says that, it's a very difficult verse to understand. But if you think about that verse within the attributes of Christ, particularly him revealing himself only to those whom he wants to reveal himself to, so he's honoring the disciple or the person he's asked to be a disciple by showing his true nature. But I think the other more important attribute is Christ's control over life and death, his power over life and death. And because he has power over life and death, burying the dead isn't so important. Mm-hmm. That being part of the faith is. So I think when we start looking at these images and thinking about how invention is working with them, is that they're really having a dialogue with the text itself and giving you this collection of things to juxtapose so that you can keep thinking, turning things over in your mind in a very focused way that can lead to understanding and perspective.
Right.
So so as a poet, thinking about invention has me moving in and thinking through these issues with imagery that, again, I don't know if I can quite prove this is what they're up to and doing. But I'm collecting an awful lot of evidence from the pages themselves and the imagery to suggest that this is really what they were doing. Because when somebody would join a monastery, and particularly the Columban Monastery, where the Book of Kells was most likely made, this would have been a true focus of their lives, to enter into, boy, the top of the goal was to perfect the mind and the heart, and so that you could have this oneness with Christ, and to have imagery play itself out in the Book of Kells. And the Book of Kells has over 2,000 unique decorated initials in it alone. I mean, how do you invent imagery on that scale unless you have some standard techniques and practices to do that? Mm-hmm. So as a poet, I think that sense of invention comes in. I think the other thing is that the Book of Kells is crazy. I think the medieval period is probably closer to the Surrealist period than any other period in time. And I love the Surrealist poets. So their sense of invention, their trust in surprise around every corner, has me looking for surprises around every corner as well. So yeah, being a poet, I think, has influenced invention. But I think it also makes me very skeptical about language. I studied under Charlie Simic, and one of his favorite things to always say was that, you know, the life of the poet is basically to constantly fail, because you never can say things like you really want them to that do the experience justice. So you're always trying to get closer and closer and closer, but you're always going to fail. And I think thinking about language as being in a constant state of failure, which that sounds very pessimistic, but I think, or cynical, I'm not sure which, but I mean, I think thinking about it as that being the state of language, I think encourages me to push both on language, but also to push on other things like visuals, to see how they can come together and perhaps speak to that human condition just a little bit more clearly or a little bit more precisely.
That's beautiful. I mean, I don't think that's pessimistic or even negative. Language, it is limited in terms of what you're able to convey, but also just thinking about who has access to it and who doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's so many different things in terms of that. So I think that healthy dose of skepticism that Charlie Simic and other aspects of your poetry background, I think that's really helpful. I mean, I think that's a really powerful way to think about it. So I never thought of it quite like that. So I think that's really interesting.
Yes, and I think, you know, I thought of this when I started to speak, and I was going to come back to it, that sense of Kairos. And I think why Surrealist, I'm so taken by the Surrealist, is that they believed in spontaneity.
Yes.
And that is Kairos. It's reading the moment, being ready for the moment. And I think, you know, particularly classical rhetoricians really work to prepare for that moment, because if the moment comes and you don't have the wherewithals to meet it, the rhetorical experience or the rhetorical moment is lost. But I think that understanding a way of being in the moment so that you can respond to it, or have ways of inventing things that make the moment more or meet its challenges, is really what it's all about. One of my favorite Surrealist stories comes from Octavio Paz, and he was visiting André Breton, and Breton was doing some work on a poem, and they were meeting for lunch, and he kind of held up his hand to wait for a moment, and he was crossing things out and reworking them, and Octavio Paz looked at him when he got up and came to him, and he said, "What were you doing? You were crossing things out and rewriting. What was that all about?" And he said, "Well, you know, I just wasn't being spontaneous enough."
I love it.
And I think that when we think about that moment, and how I like to think about that moment, is that when we kind of are isolated in our writing, sometimes that kairotic moment isn't there to kind of push us into a context where something more interesting and exciting can happen. So I think Kairos is one of those things that really drives my thinking. And I think that we need to be always aware of that, because I think sometimes in academic life particularly, we can become isolated in our work. And I think it's that involvement with people and community that really, I think, brings out the best in us and our best inventive moments.
Oh, that's good. I have chills, Bill. That's awesome. I think that's true. I think that's the heart of, I mean, hopefully why anyone, you know, begins to study it and to ponder and to meander among the concepts of rhetoric and what that looks like, and whatever little niche we end up inhabiting and looking through. So I don't know. I love that. I'm going to kind of change gears for a moment. And, you know, one of the things I did in preparation for this interview was to listen to some of the things you've said in the past. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the University of Kentucky's the College of Arts and Sciences and listened to a little short 10-minute podcast that you'd done on digitizing the past. Mm-hmm. And I was really intrigued by one of the comments you said about recovering worn or erased old Welsh writing in the margins of the St. Chad Gospels. And so I really wanted to know, you know, what are your hopes in terms of what do you want to recover in the marginalia? And then second, you know, what do you think the future of marginalia might look like? That's a big loaded question. But the first one, I'm really excited to hear what you're looking for, what you think or hope to find with that particular manuscript.
That's a great question, particularly the one about what will marginalia look like in the future. Let me hit the first one first.
Okay.
In the St. Chad Gospels, one of the things that happened with the Gospel book is that it ended up in Wales. And for a long time, people thought it was a Welsh manuscript. However, it didn't quite make sense from the marginalia of what could have happened to it. What happened was that a Welshman by the name of Gehi, and I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly, but he actually traded his best horse for the Chad Gospels and then donated it to the church. So what we think happened, it could have been the Vikings, or it could have been some other warring faction raiding Anglo-Saxon, or actually the Welsh would raid the Mercia kingdom. And it may have been a book of spoils. It would have had a jeweled cover, probably of gold with some silver in it. And they would steal these books, rip off their covers, and then pitch them. Somebody probably realized how important that manuscript was and thought they could get something more out of it. So if he's willing to trade a horse for it, it would have been worth more than a horse. I'm guessing that he came to it by questionable means. So it spent this time in Wales, so there's all sorts of wonderful mixed writing in it. It's a mixture of Latin and Old Welsh. The oldest surviving written Welsh is in the Chad Gospels. And on one page in particular, it seems clear that something has been erased off of it. And what I was hopeful to find out is, if I can recover that, is that it may give some serious clues about the provenance of the manuscript. Since we don't know for certain, it's hard to say what was there. For all we really know, it could have been graffiti that somebody was cleaning off. But most likely, it has something to say. And it's a spot that is large enough that it should have some substantial text to it. One of the interesting things is that there is a technique we can probably use to recover this. And I feel silly with saying this. The only thing it requires is a particle accelerator. And for some of the pages of the Archimedes palimpsest, what they did, as a physicist at Stanford University figured out how to use a particle accelerator to have a beam that is focused enough that would actually send, I think it's an electron, into the vellum, send something out so that it can read at the molecular level what is still there. And through that, you can recreate the text or get a shadow of the text and actually read it. I think there's 4 to 7 pages of the Archimedes palimpsest that they couldn't read through infrared or ultraviolet, and this technique actually worked for. I think to do a page, it takes about a day. So there is hope that we can figure this out sooner or later, but it's going to take some pretty dramatic means, like a particle accelerator. But my sense is that, you know, scientists will keep getting more and more clever about recovering these sort of things. So it's really kind of at the heart of the issue about where the Book of Kells was made, its history. For a long time, there was real tension between the Welsh and the English. It's at an English church at this point in time, as far as who owned the manuscript. So there were some real delicate political maneuverings that happened even as late as the year 2002. The British Library actually had a show of illuminated manuscripts and had the Chad Gospels there. And they did some imaging and created a short turning of the pages. And they had to work with both cathedrals, the cathedral in Wales and Lichfield, to make that project happen. Since then, there was an angel that was found buried beneath the cathedral when they were doing some reconstruction. And that angel has the same pigments as the Lichfield Gospels, or at least the same palette. So that seems to be pretty solid proof that the Chad Gospels was actually made in Lichfield. Mm-hmm. There's also a connection with Ireland and a connection with Northumbria, Northern England, that would suggest it to have been made in England as well. So I'm pretty certain it does have an English Anglo-Saxon origin, but I was hoping that we would find out something, even if we could recover some more old Welsh. It would add to what scholars do have that is there. But I think figuring out some of the mysteries behind the histories of these manuscripts is just absolutely wonderful, if it can happen. But alas, it didn't happen in the project.
Well, no, but I think that's great. The particle accelerator aspect of it. I mean, I come from an anthropology background, so just thinking about the archaeological aspects of that, I mean, it's huge. And so, yeah, I think it's just fascinating, though, seeing that also become part of the way that we're going to be able to detect marginalia in the future. So
yes.
I'm absolutely blown away. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is back to the future. that's amazing.
Yeah. Now, the second part of your question, I think, is very intriguing. One of my greatest joys in reading a book is to write notes in the margins. So I'd love to scribble thoughts, questions, whatever in the margins. Digital technologies change that quite a bit. And there are, you know, basically the sticky pads for books now and PDF. Acrobat allows you to do notes, but it just doesn't seem like it's quite there yet. I'm not sure what marginalia will look like in the future. I hope that it's good and messy and that we have plenty of ways of doing it, because I think many times that gives you a context that is lost otherwise. And I think that our understanding is greatly reduced without it. So I'm hoping that, you know, there will be some sorts of records, and maybe it will be, you know, when somebody's 1,000 years, 2,000 years removed from us, they'll be kind of connecting Facebook posts with an author's writing or something, or what they were reading, in ways that illuminate some of the issues and aspects of the culture that make for understanding the words resonate more deeply, is gone. One of the things, I know that librarians are thinking about this a lot, and we just built a new digital repository here at the University of Kentucky. It's coming online literally right now, and I'll be putting I've got the Chad Gospels in there. We're working out some of the interface stuff at this point in time. But the system, instead of going to a traditional database, they've gone to something called microservices, which is more like a file structure, so that you don't have a proprietary database that is another layer of complexity, but you've got this file system so you know where everything resides and you can just reach in and grab it. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be interesting to see if something like, yeah, I mean, I think the goal of JavaScript was to try to come up with kind of this universal access language that would make things programmable in ways that we have kind of everybody can use and has some sort of longevity. But I know that, you know, this is an issue that is seriously on the minds of librarians, because, you know, you change databases. How do you get something out of your old database and into the new and not lose it? And it becomes, yes, a huge issue.
In talking about just what the University of Kentucky is doing, they seem so forward thinking with a lot of the things they're doing. Not only with the librarians that you just mentioned, but also I know that, you know, the Center for Visualization and Virtual Environments that's also there that you're affiliated with. And so just thinking about that forward-lookingness of your learning institution, but also looking outward, I'm very much interested in terms of learning a little bit more about what your experiences have taught you about working with lots of different folks across disciplines, such as Brent Seals, your collaborator, who's in the computer sciences. and other colleagues that you have within that center for, or the Viz Center, as they call it. And I think the other question that I have is just, and again, I don't like pigeonholing people, but I would love to know if you consider yourself a digital humanist, and if that's something you would describe yourself as.
Let's see. I'll take the second part of that question first.
Sure.
And I think, you know, getting back to, I don't like to define myself too greatly. And I think that I do like calling myself a digital something. I'm comfortable being, you know, a digital humanist, a visual rhetorician. But I don't want to get, you know, too wrapped up in any of the titles. And I think, you know, again, I'm always thinking about the digital as much as a methodology as anything else. So I think you got me at kind of a illogical loop in my head.
No, that makes sense. Well, and, you know, the panel that I went to that I kind of briefly shared in the context of the questions, I need to remember her name, but she's at Michigan State. And one of the things she said is they're going to change the title of this, you know, don't get too caught up in what they're calling it. And she basically said the same thing you said. I mean, it's a methodology. And so, mm-hmm. you know, whether or not this is something that you call yourself or not, I think you're right. I think it's really healthy to be critical of that. So I just was curious if that was something you would dub yourself or not.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the humanist part is in there. I mean, because technology, when it first came out, the computer, it seemed so cold to people. And reducing everything to bits and bytes and zeros and ones just didn't seem to have much sensibility towards the human condition whatsoever. So I think that the, you know, as in all our technologies, we figure out how to make them feel, or how us to feel comfortable with them, so that, you know, even something simple like our screensavers or our background images that we put on our desktops suddenly allow us an expression through the technology. And I think that the humanism has probably always been in that title, or was thrown in that title early, because it was something that would unite people working in the humanities and make the technology seem less threatening or less non-human or less artificial. And I think, you know, we always have a love-hate relationship with technology. We always have to figure out how to get it to work for us. But technology also has a life of its own and invites us to do certain things that we might not like to really go down that road. So I think that skepticism towards technology, but that need or that desire or that sense that it could open up great possibilities is what probably united those two titles together, the digital humanist, digital humanities. But I think, you know, hopefully we'll get to the point where we can think about it as a methodology and not a, I don't want to say people are threatened by the digital, but I think, you know, there's a healthy skepticism towards the digital. And academics tends to be a pretty conservative place, particularly with methodology and creation of knowledge, so that I think that in many ways it can be slow to embrace new possibilities. And part of that is that once you have a research agenda in place, you know, it has a momentum of its own. And I think figuring this stuff out is time consuming. And I'm always, you know, when I think about the digital technologies, I'm always remind myself that it took, I think it was about 100 or 120 years after the invention of the printing press for the numbered index to catch on. And you say,
yeah,
how did that not catch on quicker? And I think that any sorts of change takes time. And I think that, you know, this title and the fact that people are questioning this title or thinking about this title at this point in time is saying that we are changing, that we have integrated things, the digital, into our worlds in ways that are productive, that we're starting to get a better handle on what it is and what we might want to call ourselves in the future.
Well, switching gears from that particular question, I was gonna ask you a question that's asked of many Kairos profiles, people that are interviewed. And, you know, Kairos, I was looking through the archives. I mean, everyone from Noam Chomsky to Hugh Burns to all these amazing people. I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is wonderful. But it's a great question, I think, that bears repeating, because I think at the kernel of it is just trying to kind of to distill and to really capture some of the wisdom, obviously, that you have and that others have as well. And that is, you know, what do you think's the most exciting aspect in terms of the future of computers and writing? Like, what really gets you excited in terms of thinking about that particular field?
Well, wow, that is a great question. There are so many aspects to it that I think that it for me, it's difficult to answer because I see so much open space with it. And I think that the possibilities of what we can do are just unfathomable. When we start thinking about, you know, the digital as a methodology, you know, I think that starts us moving into the area of saying, okay, this opens knowledge up to us in ways that it isn't open to us previously. Even in something, and to move it just down close and near to my heart, is I really am driven to try to figure out what these monks were up to in their visual expression. To do that, I need access to these manuscripts. And the digital makes that possible. Printing facsimile versions is just too expensive. The other problem with doing the printing of facsimiles is that we need color, because the color is a large part of being able to see these things and understand what they are about. So in thinking about the digital technologies and thinking about as a methodology, we can also think about them as a new way of seeing and opening up possibilities that we couldn't see previously. Even with something like ultraviolet imaging, and to see text that is worn and understand what's there, suddenly I'm basing my scholarship on more data, more accurate data. So I have the possibility to contribute substantially just from the possibilities of what the digital has opened up to me. Looking at the St. Chad Gospels, you've got a small cathedral that doesn't have a whole lot of money in the Midlands. It's a cathedral that when the canals went through, they were passed over. When the rail went through, they were passed over. When the motor highway went through, they were passed over. So they're kind of sitting there in the Midlands, and they've gone through a kind of a resurgent recently. But the digital technologies makes that possible in ways that for me to go in and, you know, someone from Kentucky here, to go in and digitize this manuscript and then start unlocking its secrets. And when I start unlocking some of its secrets, since it was made around probably 60, 70 years before the Book of Kells, by the time you get the Book of Kells, they're taking techniques to such extremes, sometimes it's hard to figure out what they're trying to accomplish. But by moving back to the Chad Gospels, I get an early look at those techniques as they're developing, and I get a better sense of their expression. Digital technologies makes that possible for me in ways that it wasn't before. One of the things we did too is that we took 3D images of every page, which is very cool. and we did it with a very clever, the folks at the Viz Center are very, very clever with how they figure out problems. They usually try to figure out a problem with some sort of very over-the-counter, low-cost solution. And how they did the 3D imaging is that they literally project 22 patterns over a page and take pictures of it. And from how those patterns, those shifting patterns change, they can read the contour of the page. So we've got 3D images of every page of these manuscripts. When you have 3D images, you can then measure everything. So we can measure holes in the vellum. And in 50 years, if somebody wants to know how that hole has changed, we can tell them the size of that hole in 2010. 3D, I think, is going to open up some just amazing possibilities. One of the things that we can do with the 3D images as well, then, is flatten a page. So we can get a sense of what it looked like originally and how the text and the images were actually laid out. And some manuscripts are really cockled and in horrible shape. The Chad Gospels was in good shape. It had been rebound in 1962, and Roger Powell did a wonderful job with his work. But here in just this small little area, in my little corner of the world, the digital is opening up all sorts of possibilities. And then when we start being able to compare the Chad Gospels to the Book of Kells, pulling images side by side, then we can really look at these things and start understanding them. When we start doing things like encoding the decoration, we don't know exactly why they have these minor decorated initials, the letters within the Gospels themselves, with decoration on them, some decorated, some not. They don't necessarily follow verses or chapters. There's something else going on with them. They are connected with Eusebian canon tables, lections for various readings for services, but we don't really know exactly what's going on. Once we have these manuscripts encoded, we can start comparing between manuscripts, and where they are similar, we can probably come up and gradually, through the process of elimination, figure out what they're visually expressing with these particular decorated initials. So just a kind of, again, my little corner of the world, it's opening up all sorts of possibilities for scholarship, for us to understand these manuscripts and actually see their correspondences in ways that we haven't previously. I hate to think about how this opens up the world in other ways. I know the geographers are doing some great and wonderful things as far as maps are concerned and annotations. So I think that we are just at the very beginning stages of what is going to be possible in the future. That's been one of the wonderful things about, you know, the visual turn, if I don't overuse W.J.T. Mitchell's phrasing too much here, that I think it opens up that digital, or what I should say, it opens up normal disciplinary boundaries, and that people cross over them more frequently in trying to figure out what's going on. And I think, you know, in thinking through as far as people are concerned, one of the areas that I think has happened and is very interesting is that rhetoricians who are based in English departments and rhetoricians in communication departments, they have some interaction, but not nearly what you would think that they would have. And I think one area that the communication folks have really done, you know, marvelous work has been in the visual field. Someone like Paul Massaris has just done, you know, fabulous, fabulous work. And then Lester Olson and Carla Finnegan and Diane Hope did a wonderful edited collection not too long ago with visual rhetoricians in it on the communication side, which is really quite fabulous. So one of my hopes is that dialogues will start coming into place with the visuals, and that maybe we can, you know, unite the rhetoricians in the two different fields in stronger ways. And I think the other thing that I think is, you know, kind of thinking about influences is that, you know, you start thinking about the people's work that you love, like Anne Wasaki, who has been very influential. I mean, her work is always just so smart and wonderful. And of course, you know, Cynthia Self and Gail Hauscher, which I mean, anybody working in the field of computers and composition owe them great gratitude, and the work that they've done has just been absolutely fabulous. And I think that, you know, in my work, someone like Jeffrey Sirk, who has spent time working on the Surrealists and pulling them into comp and theory and computer theory, has been very helpful. The edited collection by Charles Hill and Margaret Helmer's Defining Visual Rhetoric, which would be kind of the counterpart to Lester Olson and Carla Finnegan's book, which is just absolutely wonderful and rich with visual rhetoricians. But I think, you know, somebody else who has been very important has been the work of Günther Kress, who I don't know if he would call himself a visual rhetorician, but clearly his work with the New London Group, and actually the work of the New London Group, has been just extremely helpful. And I think when I start, you know, kind of combining all that through and then pulling from people in the field of medieval studies, Michael Camille, who is just absolutely fabulous, and then pulling someone like Scott McCloud's work in Understanding Comics, suddenly you've got kind of this dynamics of interacting voices in your head that lead to very interesting moments of kairos and invention. And of course, W.J.T. Mitchell, who I dearly love his work, and he's coming from an art historian, literary side, and he's just done just absolutely fabulous stuff.
I think that's helpful. I mean, that's really helpful too, just to have that context. So thank you. Thank you so much for making that even more explicit.
Good. I'm glad that was helpful.